Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is they're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Hello, listeners. Marika Bell here. This episode is going to be a little different. I feel like maybe I've been saying that a lot lately. I know I just said in the last episode that we were going to do a wrap-up of season 3. However, that's got pushed out a little bit, and today we're going to start a mini-series. So, here we go. This is the beginning of a mini-series. This mini-series is covering the Aggression in Dogs Conference. This is the third year of the Aggression in Dogs Conference, founded by Michael Shikashio, and this first episode is about Michael and his work with aggression in dogs. Michael is fully certified through the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants and is one of fewer than 300 CDBCs worldwide. He's also the creator of the Aggression in Dogs Master Course and currently teaches trainers and behavior consultants in more than 25 countries on how to work with aggression cases. The Aggression in Dogs Conference 2022 will be September 30th through October 2nd. When this episode releases, that's a little less than a week away, and you can still get tickets if you hurry. I attended the online version of the conference last year, and I'll be there again this year covering many of the speakers and their topics in this mini-series. I am so excited about this because who doesn't love a good conference? And there are just so many excellent conferences out there that you just can't attend them all. So if this is one where you were thinking about attending and maybe didn't this year, or maybe you're someone who did attend the conference and want to hear what the speakers have to say about their thoughts on different topics and some more in-depth information about their own experiences with aggression in dogs, then you're really going to enjoy this series. This is going to be so much fun, and I cannot wait to have these conversations and bring them to you and get you excited about learning how to work with aggression cases, and as someone with a dog companion, how to improve your and your dog's life when you're experiencing these difficulties.
All right, I'm Mike Shikashio, and he, him, and I am focusing on aggression in dogs, and that's what we're going to chat about, I hope.
Yes, definitely. So my first question for you is, what kind of questions do people ask you the most?
Well, when they, I guess it depends if they know me or not, right? So it's like the dog trainers that try to avoid talking about anything about dog training once they do it for a while. So when people ask, you know, what do you do for a living? And you try to completely avoid that question because you always get the dog question like, so, I have a dog or my uncle has a dog, and they start listing all the problems. The questions I get can be anything from when, especially if they find out I'm working with aggression cases, there's always a story, a question about that. But when it's from professionals and trainers, you know, I get a ton of questions, but all revolving around aggression or a special case. And, it can be time consuming or disappointing when I give my answer because I can't always give a straight answer because I don't know the details. And sometimes, as you know, it takes a long time to get all those details in the background in a case. So yeah, sometimes my answer is not satisfactory in a lot of those questions because unfortunately I can't give them the answers they might be looking for. So
yeah, it is funny, isn't it? Because people think, oh, you could solve my problem because you're an aggression person. So just solve my problem.
Right. It's like somebody asking, you know, how do I fix this, you know, little problem with my, you know, something mechanical, like how do I fix this little switch on my computer? Or how do I
right.
like it's an easy, quick on off switch instead of some sentient being that can be so complex and lots of questions we need to ask about what's going on.
Do you have a particular one that your clients come to you with?
I think the most common question from clients is, what can I expect? You know, what's my outcome going to be? Because in aggression cases, there's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of dynamics involved that can impact the outcome. And so that's probably the most confusing thing for them to sort of navigate, because a lot of my clients, they're going online, they're talking to their friends that have dogs, they might be talking to professionals or veterinarians, and they're going to get 100 different answers. So they end up often much more confused than when they first started out, because there's so many differing opinions, differing answers. It's like when we Google, it's like Dr. Google, right? You find some information, but our own physicians hate when we do that, because it can be very conflicting information or even completely the wrong information for the issue we're experiencing. And the same thing can happen with dogs. There's a lot of bad information, unfortunately, online. And that just conflicts with what I'm trying to impart with a behavior change strategy sometimes. So yeah. Clarifying what's the outcome, what direction to go, understanding it is all, those are the most common ones for sure.
And is that the most important question for them to be asking? What questions should they ask, do you think?
That's a good one. It's definitely a good question, because we want to be on the same page. As trainers and consultants working these cases, we definitely want to be on the same page as our client as far as their goals, because we need to set realistic expectations for what might happen with their case. So it's one of the more important ones, but I also love when people ask me, you know, how do I keep people safe? How do I keep other dogs safe? You know, safety is very, very important. And believe it or not, not everybody thinks about that, right? They maybe are discounting the severity of a dog bite or severe dog bite. And we have to sometimes remind them that it's a big problem if their dog is biting somebody. And so, yeah, that's another big one. Safety management. And then, of course, how do I fix this? How do I work on this issue is the main reason I'm there in the first place. So probably the top three. Very good questions I get from clients.
And do you think aggression cases can be fixed, or are you really looking at management more than actually fixing? What is your thought process?
You know, that's the thing about behaviors. I remind everyone that it's not a light switch, or, you know, it's a mechanical failure where we can go in and fix it like that, and then all of a sudden it's repaired or fixed because it's behavior. And it's kind of like weight gain and weight loss, right? You know, would you ever say it's fixed, right? We might get to our goal, but is it going to be like that for life? Is it fixed for life? I've lost that 10 pounds. Now I don't have to worry about it anymore. I can go eat that bag of Doritos and a box of Twinkies. I'll be good to go because it's fixed. And that's a problem, right? When we view it that way. So, you know, I use that analogy all the time with my clients, is because most clients have been through some sort of diet or weight loss, weight gain kind of situation in their life. And sometimes I'll compare it, you know, what's your dog's behavioral weight? You know, so like a dog, some dogs might have 500 pounds of behavior weight on them, meaning it's going to take a lot longer with that particular dog to change the behavior. And when we get to our goal point, if we do, it's going to take a lot of maintenance and kind of life changes. And that's kind of the better way to look at it, is because we still might see some ups and downs. You know, your dog might gain some of that behavior weight back. They might lose it, but it's going to be this lifelong journey. And so it also helps them understand that, to set these dogs up for success, we need to set their environment for success. So just like the person trying to lose a few pounds, we can't set them up for success if we're packing their fridge with soda and their cabinets with Doritos and Twinkies. You know, so we've got to have that lifestyle change. And it's the same with dogs. You know, some dogs only need to lose a couple of pounds of behavior weight, and some dogs have a long, much longer journey.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, that really works, doesn't it? I think for people who have lost weight, you also sort of come to realize that it's not necessarily the losing weight that's easy. Like when you're focused on it, that's actually not too hard once you get over that initial hurdle of getting the new plan in place and really getting used to what you now have to do in terms of dog training, you know, changing your lifestyle a little bit to fit what the dog needs. But it's that maintenance once you get to your goal, making sure you don't, you know, slip by changing your lifestyle back to what you're used to again. And maintaining those good behaviors with dog training is just as important.
You know, as you're just talking there, I was thinking about another analogy just came to mind now. And it's kind of, again, why are we gaining weight or why are we losing weight? Like what is it happening at a deeper emotional level, right? Because many times when we're gaining weight, something else is going on in our lives. That's maybe we're kind of going to food as comfort, or we're using food in a certain way, or we're losing weight because of the stress. And think about it. Same thing happens with dogs. There's this underlying reason for the aggressive behavior or their behavioral weight, right? And in order to address that, this weight gain or weight, you know, weight gain or weight loss issues that we're having or behavioral issues we're having, we've got to address that underlying emotion or motivation for that in the first place. So just thought of that. I'm like, that's another one I'm going to throw into my analogy pool, because I think that'll also understand. But it's so, that's exactly what I work with all the time. People are so focused on the biting, the snarling, the snapping, all the aggressive behaviors. But to help these dogs, vast majority of time, we have to address the underlying emotions and motivation for that behavior in the first place. You know, you help the emotions, the behavior often changes automatically, even if you don't necessarily work on that specific behavior. You work on the underlying motivations.
So in your experience then, who needs the most help? Do you get a certain kind of client that you see a lot?
You know, that's, I think the clients that need the most help are the ones that are struggling with answers as far as which direction to take. Because it's very emotional, again, especially if it's something like owner-directed aggression, you know, they've just been bitten by their dog or their dog has bitten someone they love. They are struggling emotionally, you know, what to do with this animal they love, but at the same time, it's directed at them, sort of the hand that, don't bite the hand that feeds you sort of mentality can come into play. And then also, or you're biting my partner or something like that. It can really drive a lot of conflict into the situation. And so the clients that do come to see me often are struggling with that because clients that are kind of savvy about training and they are kind of, they understand their dog. They usually have a direction they're going with already. They have like, they're pursuing the behavior change strategies. They're learning about training. They're learning about safety and management. So they're not often struggling from a standpoint of needing direction. Which way, which path do I take? What's the safest path? And often they're going to try to take the fastest path there, but sometimes we have to teach them that that might not be the safest path. We might have to take a little bit of a longer route, but yeah, that's that direction. It's the confusion again, going back to that confusion and the emotion standpoint that a lot of clients experience.
Yeah, you said something just there that got me thinking about the safest versus the fastest path. And I feel like that's something that comes up a lot with a lot of different dog training issues, but aggression particularly, because it's one of those things that people do want a really quick fix for. They're you know, potentially quite scared of what has just happened, you know, or something they didn't realize their dog was capable of. And by the way, all dogs are capable of aggression, but you know, you don't expect it. And it's something that you want to solve immediately. And a lot of people, if they don't feel like they can solve it immediately, then they don't want anything to do with it. So if there isn't a fast solution, then they don't, you know, they may not be willing to do the long solution. So what are some examples maybe of a fast solution that you think maybe isn't the best idea?
Yeah, I think the number one quick fix that's often used out there is punishment. So we can get a dog or any animal pretty much to stop any behavior if the punishment's strong enough, right? So if we use like a, you know, a real powerfully punishing stimulus like shock or something like that, most animals are gonna be like, I'm not gonna do that right now. The issue with that though, is we're not addressing the underlying motivation again. So similar again to going back to that behavior weight analogy, you know, there's quick fixes for diet too, right? We can go on a crash diet, but is that necessarily healthy? And does it really address the underlying reason for all of that in the first place, the reason for the weight gain? If we don't do that, it's a quick fix, meaning it's going to look like it works. But especially with aggression cases, that can be incredibly problematic because we might punish out what we actually want. So a dog that's learning to growl and express their feelings of saying, hey, I'm a little bit of afraid of this person approaching me, you know, on the street and trying to pet me on the top of the head or something like that. I'm going to growl at them because I'm uncomfortable. I don't know who this strange person is. So we can do something to punish the dog. We correct the dog or, you know, use a collar to, you know, correct the dog. And next thing you know, the dog's like, okay, I won't growl anymore. So it looks good, right? We're saying, oh, that works. Now the dog's not growling at strangers anymore. But what can happen is the dog's still afraid of strangers, petting them on top of the head. That stranger comes over and it's like, you know, goes to pet the dog on the top of the head. And the dog's like, oh, I can't growl, but I still don't want this person next to me. So the fastest way to get rid of this person is to bite them because I can't growl because I'll just get punished for that. But most people don't stick around for biting. right? Yeah. So they're going to go away anyways once they get bitten, and it becomes reinforcing for the dog. So the dog gets reinforced for that biting behavior, and they don't go to what we actually like, which is warning the person away, because it's not biting. We prefer growling over biting all day long. So yeah, that's probably one of the most common things I see with quick fix approaches, you know, and it's, you know, it's not, and what I often see is that it looks, again, that looks like it's working. It looks great on paper. It looks good on video, before and after video, right? But we don't, if without really digging deep into saying, hey, dog, how are you really feeling about this? And oftentimes their answer is going to be, I'm still afraid of people, you know? And it's, so it's not very fair for the animals when we, yeah, when we could really think about that.
So different question then. Can you work on aggression in any situation? I'm thinking, like, if there's a dog that comes into a shelter, is a shelter a place that people can work on aggression issues before that animal gets adopted out?
Absolutely. You can really work on behavior anywhere a dog is, in any situation when you think about it. I mean, they're always in a learning scenario, where we as humans are as well. It's that obviously we have to consider the environment and the impact on things like stress. And when a dog's in a stressful environment, there's going to be less likely for behavior change to happen or learning to happen. And of course, when it comes to chronic stress, it can be very detrimental to the animal, not only from a health standpoint, from a behavior standpoint as well. So to answer the question, yes, I think dogs can learn in an environment, but we want to, of course, set them up for success. We set our learners up for success by creating the most optimum environment for them to learn. So can we, you know, it's not to say we can just release all the dogs from the shelter because Mike said so, and we're going to train them all. It doesn't work like that, of course. We can, though, modify the shelter environment. You know, can we incorporate more enrichment? Can we do play groups? Can we do the things that we know are going to help these dogs feel less stressed? They get more enrichment, they get more exercise, and they're in a better place for learning, that then we can work on whatever the undesirable behaviors we're seeing could be.
I guess, what kind of aggression should we be worried about? Say, would you be worried about aggression in a puppy?
It's so, yes. I get that question a lot. You know, how abnormal or normal is it for a puppy to display aggression? So let's use an example. Let's say we've got a little Belgian Malinois that's really biting at people, snarling at like 10 weeks old, right? And so somebody comes to look at this dog, they want this dog, but then the dog's like really just barking, lunging, grabbing onto things, not letting go. That can be alarming to some people. It's sort of like hearing about a story of like a four-year-old child walking around with a rifle, you know, and shooting people. It's not common. It's shocking, right? It's something that's shocking to us. So I think our human mentality, we see that and we're like, oh, wow, that's severe. How could a puppy be that aggressive? Well, we have to remember that, first off, it's a normal behavior. Aggression is normal. And dogs, unlike children, learn how to use their teeth at a very, very early age, right? And they use that to defend themselves or to get themselves out of scary situations. And that's normal behavior. It's evolution. It's how we've survived as species, how dogs have survived, to use aggression to get something that's threatening to them to move away so they can survive. So to see a puppy do it, again, it seems shocking, but it's very normal. So then when you take it a step further and you look at breed-specific behaviors or things we as humans have asked a particular breed to do for the last maybe sometimes couple hundred years in our selection, you might see a Malinois puppy and all of its siblings doing the same thing because it's such a normal behavior for a Malinois versus, let's say, a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Now, if you were to say to me, Mike, I've got this 10-week-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel biting and holding and not releasing humans, that would be a little bit more abnormal. But still, in the realm of, I would say, let's see what's happening. Is it somebody really harassing the puppy, poking the puppy, or doing something really mean? And then now that Cavalier King Charles is biting that person, I would say that's very normal. That's the puppy just trying to find safety and trying to survive. So it's less common, of course, when we see it in puppies than we might see it in an adult dog, because usually you see it start to evolve when the dog's in their adolescence, so social maturity ages. So, you know, after a year old, 16, 18 months, up to 2 to 2.5 years old, depending on the breed, that's the most common age I will see cases at. So aggression is very, very common to see in that age group range versus like a 10-week-old puppy. But again, seeing a 10-week-old puppy, it may be alarming at first, but I'm still going to say we can work on this. We're going to try to work on it and try to stop doing anything that is making that puppy have to display that behavior in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's a lot of wiggle room with puppies, isn't there? Because they haven't had a whole lot of negative experiences yet, and they're not really necessarily in those critical learning stages, those critical fear periods anyway, where things really just stick with them. You have a lot of opportunity to teach them happier social
context. There's some good debate around that, right? Or good conversation we can have, because they haven't quite learned all those things, and maybe they are going to be much more flexible. So they're still learning. They're forming those connections. Though sometimes when we see a young puppy, sometimes we have to ask, okay, is this genetic? Is it more something, or even going back to like before the puppy was even born, is this an in utero stress thing where it's been passed on from the mom to the puppy in utero, where it's kind of prepared for the dog or the puppy for stressors, and they're more likely to be hypervigilant? So it's hard to, of course, no one's able to say exactly for sure, but we can make educated guesses about just how much is this genetic versus, that whole nature and nurture. The answer is, it's almost always both in most of these aggression situations, but it can be heavily leaning towards one or the other, depending on what that puppy's experienced. So yeah, it's sometimes it's easier and sometimes it's not, depending on what's influenced the behavior.
Yeah. So, I mean, in your experience, what constitutes aggression versus just rambunctious play behavior? Because there are a lot of puppies that they just play really rough. And should people be worried about that turning into aggression?
That's another great question. I think it takes a little of observation over time to really say, okay, this could become problematic. So let's say we have, some 10-week-old puppies and somebody calls me, they're playing kind of rough. I'm just not sure what to do. It's not a good idea just to look at that one moment, unless it's really overt, like one dog is just pinning the other down, just going for the throat and shaking them and things, something really extreme like that. Obviously, we want to intervene. But let's say it's like borderline, just it seems rough. First thing you want to do is say, is this kind of normal for that breed? Some puppies are going to play much more, have a different play style. They're much more rambunctious, rough with the other puppies. So I'd be first looking at that. But then I would say, is this something that we need to actually work on? And the way to know that is data over time. So like, are the puppies starting to learn from each other? Okay, this is not quite going to work out when I play this rough because my litter mates say, ouch, and I don't want to keep playing that rough, so I'm going to stop. So then that puppy learns like, okay, if I want to keep playing, I can't be so rough with my litter mates. So if we see that, sometimes we see the move into a positive direction, right? So we don't have to really do much at that point. Now, on the other hand, you might see it go into a negative direction, and we do have to step in and look at behavior change strategies and good management. So it's to differentiate between rambunctious and true aggression is that observation and data. You also have to define, what aggression is. That's another big question I get, right? Like, how do you define aggression? And the most simplistic way that I put it is it's behavior. So the growling, snarling, snapping, biting behaviors used with the function. So the function of that behavior, it's used to increase distance from a threatening or provocative stimulus or that is threatening their resource or themselves. So it's, behavior used to survive, basically, whether it's a threat to their resources or their own personal being or somebody that they actually care a lot about that's also providing resources. That's the function of it. Mm-hmm. And puppies playing in the same litter, typically, that's not the function of what they're doing with that really loud, rambunctious biting. Sometimes you hear growling. So the behaviors look the same, but the function is different. So they could be doing that as in play. I want you to play more roughly with me. And so I'm biting, growling at you as a puppy. And of course, it takes a little bit of a trained eye to see the difference in that. But most of the time, their goal is not to increase distance from a threatening stimulus. They're actually trying to decrease distance from their puppy playmate that they get to play rough with. So there's some differences there. And it's important to kind of determine why the dog is doing that.
Now, I know that you are going to be holding a aggression in dogs conference coming up very soon. And one of your speakers will be talking about prey behaviors as well, predatory and prey behaviors. But just to touch on that really quickly, would you, based on what you just said, when a dog is performing predatory aggression, would you consider that aggression then? Because that's not really a distance increasing behavior, mm-hmm. but it certainly could kill or hurt another animal.
That's another great question. It's interesting. You know, I've researched for a long time, right? And I've had a lot of conversations with ethologists and folks with applied behavior analysis backgrounds. And for me, I've come to the conclusion, I finally like said, okay, I've got to come up with an answer for myself so that way I can answer this when I get interviewed on a podcast or something. And so I don't define predation or predatory behavior like that as aggression because the function is to decrease distance. So okay. The dog is looking, let's say, to get closer to that rabbit. So that's the goal or the function of the behavior, to decrease distance. And then, of course, acquisition of that prey. And not all dogs go through the whole predatory motor sequence, which is, you know, eye stalk, chase, grab, bite, and then the whole kill, bite, and consume process. Some dogs stop at just the chase because it's fun for them. So it's behavior where the function is actually, it's satisfying a much different type of underlying emotion. So with a true aggression, it's usually fear, anxiety, something like that, that is fueling that behavior. With predation, it's a completely different circuitry happening in the brain. They're much more cognitive about what they're doing, but they're also having fun doing it most of the time. They're satisfying a different need, different neurochemicals in play also. So as they're decreasing distance, they're kind of satisfying that need to go after that particular animal. So the function's different. What's happening in the brain is different. So it's not aggression at all for the classification. Might seem very aggressive to the victim, to the animal, that rabbit, and be like, hey, why are you being so aggressive? But it's from when you're looking at the dog, I don't define it as aggression. The proper terminology would be either predatory behavior or predation. So predatory behavior would describe the behaviors we're seeing, the eye, stalk, chase, grab, you know, and you can see variations of that. Every dog on the planet has some part of the predatory motor sequence. And they express it in different ways, depending on the breed and also the individual dog. But you'll see that you can see some of those predatory behaviors come out. So this chasing the child on the bike. But what's the function? Is it to make that child go away because it's a threat to the property? Maybe they're scared of children, or maybe they're having fun because they're chasing something on a moving object that starts to squeal and make predatory sounds afterwards. So that's how I define the difference. And again, you might get different answers depending on who you interview, but that's where I'm going with it.
That's good. It's decisive. would you say aggression is ever okay?
Sure. It's again, natural behavior. It's our own human constructs that make it not okay. Right. So we might see a child riding a dog like a pony around the house because they haven't been told not to do so. So is that dog snarling and snapping at the child or just turning and kind of growling? Is that normal or abnormal? Is it desirable or undesirable? It really depends on, you know, who's looking at it. And obviously most of us would consider it undesirable behavior, but it's quite normal, right? When you think about it, it's the dog's just responding to something that maybe hurts or doesn't want some small human being riding around on their back, you know? Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, the vast majority of the time, the aggression is quite normal and it's quite understandable. And it's, again, survival. So as humans, right? Imagine us as humans, the same thing. Imagine if dogs were, you know, telling us what to do in our lives and controlling all of our activities. If they looked at us and kind of said the same thing, hey, you know, why are you getting so upset when somebody takes your food away while you're sitting at your favorite restaurant, right? How dare you get so upset? That's ridiculous. You could never say anything to another person for doing that. That's undesirable. And that's our own constructs, or that would be the dog's construct in that example. So it's, if you look at most aggressive behavior, it's quite normal, quite understandable. I guess the caveats to that would be the maladaptive type of behaviors. And that's, again, usually because of our human faults, right? So if you look at, let's say, a border collie that's chasing children around the backyard or in your house, your guest gets up to go to use the bathroom and the border collie just like chases you down and grabs at your ankles or heels. And you go a little, and you're like, wow, that was really aggressive. Why did the dog do that? If you dig a little deeper, maybe you get the history. This border collie's from working stock and is used to, it comes from a lineage of lots of herding and, you know, doing great work in that aspect. And now somebody's adopted this dog and stuck them in an apartment in a big city or something like that. So they're not getting any enrichment, or we're not meeting any of their needs. So you start to see maladaptive behavior where the dog's saying, hey, I can't do what you guys have asked me to do as humans for the last 200 years. Now I have to express it somewhere else. So I guess there's people moving around the house. That's pretty close. So I'm going to keep them on the couch because that's what I've been bred to do historically. And so that might seem, again, abnormal and really strange, but it's normal when you look at the whole situation. It's become maladaptive. The dog's now exhibiting what we would consider abnormal aggression because of our own, you know, faults of not meeting that dog's needs from our ancestors asking for so many things that it would do in a totally different environment.
Right. So why did you focus on aggression in your work?
I started as a trainer, working in the, you know, sit down, stay, come, those kind of basic foundational skills we used to focus on as trainers. And I was at the time I was doing a lot of fostering dogs. So yeah, actually I was fostering first, then became a trainer. But as you're fostering dogs, you end up getting a lot more difficult dogs as the rescues start to learn, hey, you know, Mike's pretty experienced, so send the difficult ones there, because you don't want to just send the first difficult dog to your new foster, because they're gonna be like, I'm never fostering again. So that kind of made me catch the behavior bug, because I wanted to help these dogs more, because I found the dogs with behavior issues, of course, they're surrendered back to the rescue or face worse outcomes. So I asked myself, you know, how can I really help these dogs, you know, stay out of the rescue or shelter situations? Because one of the most common reasons for surrender to shelters or rescues is because of behavior. And then I really start to see just how many dogs it's because of the aggressive behavior, even at low levels. So completely safe to adopt out again, so maybe a little growl here or there. Completely not something I would be considering unethical to adopt out again. But they sometimes would get returned because they're growling and people are finding it offensive that, how dare my dog growl at my child riding it around the house like a pony. So I found the need to really start to educate the public, as well as work with trainers and go, you know, take a deep dive into all things aggression in dogs, because I found that was the kind of the most direct path to helping as many dogs as possible. So one thing led to another, and it's been rolling along on this aggression thing for about the past decade or so now. So that's how I got into it, and that's where I am now.
And why start the conference? When did you start the conference, and why?
Yeah, so it came out of, again, the educational aspect. There was hardly anything on aggression when I first started about 20 years ago in training. So I really, you know, I went headfirst, as I do when I want to learn something new. I go out and get all as much as I can. So I went out and bought all the books on like Dogwise and on aggression, and pretty much consumed everything I could. And within a year, I'm like, there's really not a lot left from people working with aggression. There's a lot of research and papers you can read and continue diving deep into the research. But from a dog training standpoint, that was it. I was like, okay, so there's a gigantic void there was in our learning at that time. So I continued along that path. All right, let me start with a little course, little webinars here and there. I started doing little speaking engagements, and then I said, there's a lot of other great speakers out there, and they're not, you know, we're not collecting all this information to one place. So that's how the conference came about. I was like, why don't we just have an annual conference where I try to find the best of the best, and then we'll get them all on stage or in one location together and have a whole conference about that, so we can see different viewpoints, so we can hear about different strategies, and have a way of create this community around it too. You know, let's create a place, a safe place, where everybody can discuss a very emotional topic that often has lots of controversy and different viewpoints around it, but create a very safe and kind atmosphere to do that. So the Aggression and Conference was born, and Dogs Conference was born about 3 years ago. So this upcoming one is the third annual one. And and I, you know, I love where it's going. I love the community it's creating, and the information that's, you know, being able to get out there to help dogs with aggression and their owners.
All right. And the conference is, remind me of the dates.
September 30th to October 2nd this year. And mm-hmm. we're going to be in Providence, Rhode Island, three full days with 13 different speakers, all on aggression.
So great. So great. And there's an online version as well.
Yes. So yes. This is actually the first year we have the in-person component with the lovely pandemic. We had to go to online options the first 2 years. But this is the first year we're doing both online and in-person. So we'll be streaming from Providence for the online version. We did the same thing in Chicago last year where we streamed from a television studio there.
Yeah, that was great. I attended that conference. That was really excellent information.
It was a lot of fun, and we had a great team helping us with the technical aspects. So that same team's coming out to Providence, and we're going to be filming and streaming right from Providence with the same production team right to this platform. It's called the Cassell Events. It's this really cool sort of conference, online conference platform. So yeah, I'm excited. It's great to be able to do both in person and online this year.
Yeah. Well, I love what you're doing, because I found the same thing. I started probably doing dog training around the same time you did, it sounds like. And I was probably in my area. I was in New Zealand at the time when I started taking clients, and there was pretty much no dog trainers that would take aggression cases. I would have people call me and say, you know, I've called five other trainers, and some of them are, you know, hours away, and they won't take aggression cases. And I told them my dog, you know, bit me, and they just don't want to talk to me after that. And the funny thing was, occasionally I would talk to them on the phone, and it would turn out that, like, the dog had nipped them because, like, they had tried to take some food away, or they were even puppy growling. I occasionally got calls because they were worried their dog was aggressive, and they hadn't actually explained it. The other trainers hadn't even asked that far. They just heard the word aggression and just didn't want to touch it. And so half the aggression cases I caught weren't even really aggression cases. You know, they were rough play, or they were, you know, something else. But the ones that were really aggressive, you know, dogs that had bitten someone on the hand significantly, or, you know, something like that.
Okay. Just as a quick aside, calling a dog aggressive is actually a misnomer. Dogs aren't aggressive, but they do show aggressive behaviors. Okay. Now back to the interview.
And even though I was a relatively new dog trainer, I felt that there were so few people helping, that these dogs needed help and the people needed help. And you're right, there was so little information out there. I mean, I guess luckily I came from a background of working with big cats. So mm-hmm. a dog that bit me on the, you know, bit somebody, I never actually got bitten. A dog that bit somebody, I wasn't super worried about because I figured if I could handle a lion or a tiger who, you know, by nature was expected to actually try to eat you if you did the wrong thing, I could probably be okay with a big dog. But people have a real, as you say, emotional response when a dog bites or aggresses in any way, even if it's a growl.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Right. Then what you're just talking about there is such an important point, is that, you know, most people would see a lion or a tiger and be like, okay, I've got to be careful. I can't just go in and take this lion's bone away, right? Or this, you know, I can't ride this. I can't put my kid on this lion's back and have it ride around the house, right? So we have this really interesting cultural expectations of dogs in our society, right? And it's so interesting, even in the US here or in other countries where dogs are mostly kept as pets, we have sort of unrealistic expectations again of an animal that's living in our home. Because if you look at the rest of the dogs on the planet, you know, most dogs aren't actually owned by anybody. And the expectations are so different, right? And so it's I think, an interesting, it keeps us in business though, because the cultural aspect, like how dare the dog bite or growl or do anything like that. But in cultures where dogs are more like, you know, the pigeon in Central Park or the lion out in the jungle or something like that, where it's a respected animal. And we understand that, hey, some things we do could get our hand bitten off if we're not careful. So it's interesting to me that kind of cultural aspect of it. So, but yeah, there's definitely been an explosion in the number of trainers taking aggression cases, and compared to what you were talking about 20 years ago, there's nobody around. But, you know, we're definitely seeing that there's more help available. But guess what? There's still not even close to enough trainers available or veterinary behaviorists or really anybody that's working with aggression to help all of the dogs that and their owners that need this help.
And the importance of somebody who has the experience of science-based training as well. Mm-hmm. You know, certified dog training versus, mm-hmm. As you say, some sort of quick fix methods that they've seen on TV.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's something, you know, you do want to make sure the person is experienced with, and that's the key word, you know, if you might have somebody that is even science-based or takes on a particular type of behavior or is used to training, somebody that's even could have been training for 10, 15 years in a particular area of dog training, but they may not have the experience with the aggression. So I think that's one of the most crucial aspects is having that experience. And whether it's, again, through actually taking the cases or learning online or learning through conferences or courses, whatever it is, but it's a niche. It's something that's just like any other career and somebody goes into a specialty. It's important to get experience in that, especially if it's with pointy teeth on the other end of your that client, right?
Yeah, that's the thing people don't remember, right? Dogs are predators. That's what they started out as. And the fact that we can live with them is kind of amazing.
It sure is, especially from the things that I'm sure you see the same, though. But what we do as humans sometimes, again, it's amazing how tolerant dogs really are.
Absolutely. So if there was a book you could gift to all of the listeners, what would that be?
So I'm going to be probably a little cliche here in terms of dog trainers, but The Culture Clash by Gene mm-hmm. Donaldson. Mm-hmm. Maybe a guest or two on your show have mentioned that, but it's a game-changing book for most trainers that have, you know, I started out using a lot of aversive techniques and tools that are designed to punish the behavior. Like a lot of trainers start out on that path, right? It's you kind of get the information you get with whatever you can find through. So whatever you're exposed to, that's kind of, that shapes your learning history mm-hmm. and your style of training. So I didn't know anything about positive training really until I stumbled upon that book as a suggestion from another positive trainer. Mm-hmm. And it really opened up a whole new world of, hey, there's a lot of different ways you can approach behavior change. So it's a pivotal book. It's definitely one that, you have to read several times, and you also have to be open to learning from, you know, mm-hmm. if you're kind of stuck in one particular methodology, it's tough to kind of digest, especially in Jean's writing style too. She admitted to me when I was chatting to her, she might have changed some of the tone if she was to rewrite mm-hmm. that book today. But, I think it's such a pivotal, you know, it's a seminal book. It really mm-hmm. is for trainers. So yeah, that's my book of choice. Yeah.
That was definitely one of my earlier reads. I loved her idea that if you were picked up by an alien and, you know, dropped off in an alien home and there was something that looked like a toilet in their house and you used it as a toilet and then they just freaked out, you know, and smacked you with a newspaper and you would be so confused. And the alternative is when someone actually explains to you what, you know, what things are used for and what is expected of you versus just punishing you for the things that you're doing wrong. You know, you can make a lot of mistakes before you figure out what it is you're actually supposed to do right. So if people can focus on that part and teaching the animal what they're supposed to do right, what it is that you actually want, then you can just sort of get rid of all of those punishments that, you know, that you didn't need anyway and didn't really help the training go quickly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wouldn't that be nice? Like that was the immediate approach of all of our clients and just people that are getting dogs, but that's our job as trainers and consultants to kind of help them in that journey.
So can you share an early childhood formative memory of your connection with animals?
I would, you know, it's interesting. I had an interesting childhood when it comes to animals. You know, my parents weren't big animal people. They got a dog. Our first dog was this dog, Happy, black lab sort of dog. And then our second dog was this collie named Sarge, looked just like Lassie. But those dogs were kept outside. You know, they were not really allowed in the house. Not a whole lot of enrichment, not a lot of exercise for those dogs. So it's interesting that I'm even, you know, working with dogs now, because I wasn't raised around dogs. I wasn't raised around animals, or even thinking about, you know, caring for animals. So I would say that though Sarge probably was the one that I think started shifting my journey into that, because he ended up getting heartworm, and I didn't know what heartworm was. I was like probably 9 or 10 years old at the time. And you know, I ended up seeing his decline, you know, and his decline in his health, and was really the one person in the family that really was paying attention to that and just kind of very concerned. And because my parents were kind of like matter of fact about it, not making a big deal about it. So, but a lot of the time I spent with Sarge towards those, you know, the last couple months of his life, he was, I just saw him differently. You know, I kind of learned new ways of interacting with him, sort of this like, you know, feeling bad for him, and not something, again, it was like a new kind of almost emotion for me as a kid. So, I guess that was like the first big learning experience that an animal taught me about, you know, their emotions, you know, and the way they look at you, their decline in health, their decline in life changes, all of those things taught me a lot. So yeah, looking up at Sarge, wherever he is now.
Yeah. Good dog.
Yeah. He was a great dog. He put up with a lot, and just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we sometimes look back on how, you know, this sort of mentality of how good dogs had it back in the day, you know, no leashes, they just got to roam the neighborhood and all of that. But the training techniques were typically a lot more punishment based. Mm-hmm. And actually I think that dogs have it better now overall, but I don't know. I guess there's some room for argument there.
Some debatable things that we do to dogs now, but yeah, definitely from a veterinary care and health standpoint, for sure. From the training approach standpoint, in many ways, for sure. But I think there's a lot of extremes we've gone to in our society that maybe aren't so good either. So good topic for another episode, I'm sure.
Yes. So, Mike, what is the deal with animals?
What is the deal with animals? Can I change that to what is the deal with dogs?
Yeah.
What is the deal with dogs? You know, it's such a top of mind question for me right now, because I am working on for the opening talk of the Aggression in Dogs Conference is looking at, you know, what is a dog? Because when we think about, when we say dog, what's the first thing that comes to mind? You know, so if you're listening right now, when I say dog, you know, what's your dog like? Or if you're going to get a dog, what's it going to look like? And something comes to mind, a picture comes to mind, or maybe a particular breed or a dog from a certain location. That's what we think of in our society. But it's a very narrow lens of all of the dogs out there. And so I ask myself, you know, what is a dog really like? And the vast majority of the dogs on the planet are not like the dogs that might come to mind, right? So we think of pet dog, we think of own dog, we think of dog with a lot of restrictions in their movements in their life, but we forget about the 750 million out of the 900 million or so dogs. It's a rough estimate, depending on who you ask, but about 750 million of the dogs are not owned by anybody. Those are a dog. So when you want to define what a dog is, Ray Carpenter actually has a book on it, and it's exactly, you know, it's you know, I completely resonate with everything Ray wrote in that book, because it's, if you travel around, you get to see all of these dogs, and they're so much different than our pet dogs from a look standpoint, from a behavior standpoint. And you have to ask yourself the question, you know, what is the deal with these dogs, and why are they sometimes so much happier in their environments than a lot of the dogs that we try to give the best to? We give them the best medical care. We give them these special treats from the store. We go and buy them these fancy toys and dog beds. And yet they're sometimes miserable or display these really strange behaviors or these behavior issues that come out from the environment that they're in or the culture that they're exposed to. And then you go to other places where they're sleeping on the dirt, or, you know, they're eating out of garbage cans. They don't necessarily have an owner. Maybe they roam around. They have to deal with the weather and things like that. But sometimes they're often much happier, much more content. There's sort of this like feeling or look of contentment that you can see in those dogs as you walk by them. They just look very, very happy about life, or sort of like, I've got no problems here. I'm living as a dog. And so, yeah, that's, you know, that's what's the deal with animals, or what's the deal with the dogs that I'm thinking about right now.
Nice. Yeah, really important questions. And I think good context for people to think about dogs in.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for this. And would you, where do people go if they want to find out more about you, about aggression, about the Aggression in Dogs Conference?
Easiest place to go is aggressivedog.com. So it should be easy to remember. And that's singular, so it's not aggressive dogs. It's aggressivedog.com. And they can find everything there. I've got the conference info there, all the speakers, everything you want to learn, or kind of learn more about the conference and who's speaking, what the topics are. I've got the podcast information there. I've got course information, free videos, free articles as well. So it's like the one-stop place I want to create for everything you want to know about aggression in dogs.
Your podcast is called The Bitey End of the Dog.
Yes. Yep. And I launched that just a couple of years ago as well. This is the third season for that. And I'm really happy with, I never would have thought it would have taken off like it did. I kind of did as a little side project. One of my students was nudging me. She was like, you know, you should start a podcast. I'm like, oh, I don't know. It's like, yeah, podcast. I'm like, I'll try it. So started as like a little side hobby project the first year. And it just started taking off way beyond my expectations. I'm like, how are people going to be really interested in, you know, such a niche topic? It's about dogs, and then people listen to that, but dog behavior, so maybe a little less dog behavior that focuses on aggression. I was like, there's probably like, you know, a handful of people that are really interested in that niche of a topic, but it's surpassed my wildest dreams. You know, it's made the top 200 of all Apple podcasts in 1 week, in at one of the weeks, but it made the top 200 of all podcasts on the planet. And I'm like, how is that even possible?
You know, yeah, that's awesome.
That much traction. So
it's such as you said, emotional topic, an important topic, one that people think about. And if they've had any sort of any dog, but particularly an aggressive dog, then, you know, it's something you want to find out about. So it doesn't surprise me that that's a really important and interesting series for people.
Yeah. And I'm really happy with the direction it's taking too, and the feedback I'm getting in terms of, it's just creating more conversation and more collaboration among professionals in our community, because it's a very, it can be very, like, there's a lot of conflict, let's face it, in the dog training world, and lots of differing opinions and people battling on social media and all those kind of things. So again, I want to create another safe place where people can come together and have differing opinions sometimes, but still have nice, kind conversations about these things without attacking each other. And you kind of have to, of course, start on that sort of main talking point, that stage, but then it trickles down. And I found that trickle down effect of, hey, you can actually talk about these things and be nice to each other at the same time. You know, kindness, compassion, and empathy really go a long way. And so really happy with the direction that's taking as well.
True for people and for dogs, isn't it?
Yes, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm looking forward to chatting with a lot of the speakers in the upcoming episodes from the Aggression in Dogs Conference that's coming up. We're doing a little mini series. And I hope everybody, if you enjoyed this episode, comes and listens to a bunch of those too, because there's so much more to come. It's going to be so much fun.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I appreciate your time.
That was Michael Shikashio, founder of the Aggression in Dogs Conference. The show notes include all of the links that we talked about in this episode, including Michael's book recommendation. And don't worry, if you wanted to hear more about children and other animals, that series will continue after this miniseries has finished in just a couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, enjoy the Aggression in Dogs Conference via miniseries on the Deal with Animals podcast with Marika Bell. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. The Deal with Animals was produced by me, your host, Marika S. Bell, and theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff. Until next time, what do you think is the deal with animals? The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network. What do you think is the deal with animals?